It's Gouda.
Right now, five.
Good afternoon. I'd like to bring the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Accountability to order, please. Committee and those listening, we have three bills up for a public hearing today. We do not have any major introductions today. Is that correct?
That is correct, Mr. Chairman.
So with that, I think I'm going to take them in the order that they appear on the agenda. So going first will be House Bill 3658. Patrick, would you give us just a brief summary of the bill?
Sure will, Mr. Chair. Thank you. House Bill 3658 requires a general contractor constructing a new residential dwelling to provide the original owner with a warranty of workmanship and materials. The measure specifies that violations are subject to a civil penalty not to exceed $5,000. It would apply to construction commenced on or after September 1st, 2010, and there's an emergency clause, so it would take effect upon passage and signature by the governor. I don't believe we have any additional materials in your packet besides the staff measure summary in the bill, Mr. Chair.
And
disregard.
I know that Craig Smith from the CCB is not signed up to testify and probably may not want to, but I would request that you come up just for a moment just to introduce the topic for us and where the state of Oregon is at in terms of protection for consumers on new construction.
He was prepared.
Looks like he's ready, yeah.
I don't know how you guessed that you would come up with.
Chair Hulvey, Craig Smith, Construction Contractors Board, and of course it's a privilege to be before you at any time for any reason. This particular bill is probably a plus because it has nothing to do with pay twice. And so we bring to you today some analysis on House Bill 3658. We've got a little bit of an outline here. What this bill would do, of course, this is a committee bill. This bill would replace the current requirement in law of a home builder to offer a warranty to a consumer with a mandate to provide a specific warranty type of product. And as I have looked at the bill, it looks like it would be a 2-year warranty on most everything, and then about a 5-year warranty on the major building components. So the handout that I've given you here talks about each one of the sections. We, of course, were not instrumental in writing this bill, as you well know. I wanted to share with you, however, that we did check with our National Association of State Contractor Licensing Agencies, who did a poll and took a look at other states. There are not a lot of states that mandate these types of warranties. There is one state that does, and that's Montana, that I was able to pull some law from, and you'll see that towards about the fifth page in from the beginning with a little handwritten Montana on there. And so that'll give you some idea of what's going on in the other states. I also wanted to give you some benefit of some of the work we've been doing the last couple of days, which depict what's going on in some of the other states with regard to certain licensing laws. And so there's a chart in there. Since I've got a couple of minutes, I've got your ear. The first chart, the United States, it's got the yellow in the middle, gives you some idea of what's going on with licensing boards and registration boards, the green being your registration, a little bit less onerous than the licensing of the brown. It's interesting where you see that brown. The center of the United States has a little bit less in terms of regulation. Commercial law, on the next page, again, you see licensing and registration applications. It's very similar. And you'll notice, again, on the coasts, and particularly down south, the southern coasts, you have the more of the regulation environment. I like the information provided on the next one, or the third map, that indicates the states with both bond requirements and liability insurance. Bonds are somewhat onerous. Probably some of your constituents have contacted you to indicate that they're having trouble getting funds. Most people don't, but because they're closely tied to a credit rating, sometimes contractors have a difficult time, particularly in this economy, getting those bonds. So the crosshatched indication on this map is your bond states, or your liability insurance states, and then the brown are the bond. The last little indicator here, the last map, shows the requirements for a recovery fund. Most states don't have recovery funds, but I thought it would be interesting for you to see, Chairman Holby, what states do, and those are the ones with the green on that last map. So I'll just sum up if I can and answer any questions. We've taken a look at the bill. If you pass this and it becomes law, we'll be happy to administer it. We do not see a significant fiscal impact from the Construction Contractors Board side. If you choose to go with this, there may be a significant impact upon small business.
Thank you, Craig. I'm going to start out with a question, because I know that, though a lot of states don't have typical home warranties as described like this one, some states have different other types of protections like the implied warranty. And I think when I was looking at implied warranty for Oregon, it's a 1 year. And in California, it's 4 years, I believe, when I was looking at the data that you came back with on that. And certainly, can you explain to us what the difference between that is and a home warranty?
Well, Chair Holby and members of the committee, I wish I was an expert in that area. I'm not. The implied warranty laws, of course, do differ from state to state. Oregon has, of course, some laws that reflect to that. But as far as the Construction Contractors Board goes, we don't get involved with that too much. We have a claims process that is predicated on negligent and improper work. You often heard the term statute of repose. That's the period of time that a contractor can be sued. And Scott may be a better source to tell you what's going on with Oregon and other states with regard to that. That'd be my best response.
Okay. Fair enough. Questions from the committee? Thank you for that brief introduction. Before you get down, I do want to recognize that this was a recommendation that originally came from the Construction Claims Task Force in 2006 or 5 or 7 or something. It was visited by this committee previously as one of those recommendations, and I believe that the governor's office actually sponsored the bill at that point. So the CCB did sponsor a home warranty bill in the past. Is that correct?
Well, the Task Force on Construction Claims was a legislative task force. Of course, the governor's the executive branch participated in appointing members to that task force. Both DCBS and Construction Contractors Board appointed members. And then, of course, as you will recall, of course, this is water that's gone under the bridge quite a bit, but in 2005, that legislation was passed. During 2006, that body met for over a year, or close to a year, talked to dozens of peoples, and produced a report for you about a half an inch thick about different recommendations. Many of those made it into bills, and then you passed two or three major bills that provided a lot of protections to consumers, but the warranty issue was not among them.
Okay, good enough. Just wanted to provide that background leading up to this. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. I think I'd like to have Scott Berry go ahead and come up, and since he might be able to answer a couple of those questions for me to start with.
Good afternoon. Scott Berry on behalf of the Oregon Home Builders Association. And Chair Holby, did you want me to take some questions first, or...
I know you've got some short. I know you've testified on this previously. You have some short comments to make, and I know you're not supportive of the bill. So, but I wanted to get that on the record since we are now in a public hearing. That's part of the February session.
Yeah, that's correct, Chair Holby. As we have testified about, I think 2 or 3 weeks ago, we do have some concerns about this bill. They surround. some of the language in the bill, such as a 5-year warranty on workmanship, and workmanship is not defined. There's issues around being able to find a warranty product so that contractors could actually step down from their business, retire, and actually not have to worry about 5 more years of insuring that workmanship product without being able to find a product like a 210 insurance product that would insure them that they could purchase to make sure the homeowner's covered. And many of our contractors today use those warranties to cover things like the structure for 10 years. Statute of repose in Oregon is also 10 years. We're required to have liability insurance. And in just taking part of the day today to kind of peruse the information that Mr. Smith from the Contractors Board put forward, I did want to point out that we are, if not near the top, at the very top of consumer protection in all of the categories that the state contractor licensing research showed. So I think that's a positive step for Oregon. I think that's been something that's really happened in the last 5 to 7 years. And so certainly, you know, kudos to the legislature and the contracting groups and the consumer groups for putting that stuff together and moving forward with it. But this particular piece is certainly not something that we would be able to support for those reasons.
So, Mr. Berry, I'm curious, you know, in my previous question, Craig alluded that you may be able to answer my question about the implied warranty versus an express warranty that we're talking about here.
I will try, Representative Pulby. I'm not an attorney. The express warranty, well, the implied warranty, is my understanding, is the both the 1-year warranty that's that is implied and the 10-year statute of repose that is also in place. An express warranty specifically talks about what is covered and what is not covered, and that would be something more similar to the 210 warranty that many of our contractors purchase and provide on homes they sell, and in some cases can be provided and purchased for existing homes before they're sold, to give them a potential benefit to a new consumer who's coming in and buying an existing house as well.
So, on following up with that, is the Home Builders Association, have they considered supporting a bill that would require a 210 warranty?
Chair Holby, that may be something down the road we would consider. I'm not going to say we wouldn't consider it. We haven't discussed it. Again, a number of our builders already use it, a large percentage. We've got some of those numbers, I would say, somewhere between, and 210 is a product, so I shouldn't specifically talk about that warranty. There are other home warranties out there that are used that are very similar. So let me make that distinction. But I know that that many of our builders use those products, and somewhere, I think, between 30 to 50% of all houses sold, at least by our membership, tend to carry warranties like that.
And when you spoke just briefly about workmanship, defective workmanship covered in those warranties?
Well, Chair Holby, I think that gets into part of the problem. Defining defective workmanship versus structural problems or product warranties, whether it's windows or dishwasher, and getting into things like a crack in the tile, the grout of a tiling job, or potentially the drying out of caulking on windows. Does that get into workmanship issues? It may, but defining where you cross that line between standard workmanship and poor workmanship, I think, is where we have some of our concerns.
So guessing that the warranties that you speak of in these 210s, they don't cover defects due to poor workmanship.
Chair Holby, I would say that they do cover defects in many cases, but again, covering workmanship gets into that trouble with defining what workmanship is good and what's not. I mean, I know that even from one jurisdiction to the other with the building code, even though the building code is a written document, even from inspector to inspector within a certain city, you will find different interpretations of what the building code is or is not, and that's been a constant problem in the construction industry, as you are probably aware. But I think we'd have a similar concern with defining what workmanship is, and it may end up that we end up solving most of that stuff in the courts, which I think is part of our concern.
Okay. Other questions from Mr. Berry? I know the committee is probably exhausted from yesterday, but or maybe exhausted from the topic, I suppose, perhaps. I appreciate your testimony, and I did want to at least get it on the record that the home builders were opposing the warranty bill, which, you know, I wished we could find a better protection for consumers out there, because I think we do have a need for that in the construction industry. So it's my little 2 cents worth, and I hope we can continue to work on that.
We'd certainly be happy to. Thank you.
Next up, I'd like to have go ahead and get Drew Hagedorn and Brian Krieg up.
Thank you,
Chair Holvey. Introduce yourself for the record, please.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Brian Krieg here today representing the Sheet Metal and Air Conditioning Contractors and the Plumbing and Mechanical Contractors Associations. We have contractors throughout the state, many of them little small mom-and-pop operations scattered in small towns everywhere. This bill, we're in opposition to it. I mentioned some of the reasons in the meetings back in January. We had a chance for our organizations to look at it. I think that it's a real game-changer a lot for small businesses. I would really echo everything that Mr. Berry said, and that's a rare thing for me to do, actually, but the key issues are the expenses that this would run into, new paperwork, new procedures that are out there, long-term liability issues for the ownerships, and things of that nature. I would point to a situation we had here. Bonding is getting very difficult, and the situation for one of my contractors located right here in Salem, Day Heating and Plumbing, they have been around since World War II, got a very nice contract to do some retrofit of furnaces for homes for the Salem Housing Authority. The contract was of a certain size. Normally, they would do work up to that size. Problem was, as they went to their bonding agent, said, we've got this great new contract, we're going to do this, and the bonding companies are really cracking down on things at the moment. They're really screwing things down, and they said, no, we're not going to bond you for that amount. This is a company that's not ever had problems. Pillar of the community. Can't get the monies out there, can't get the bonding to secure that work. Luckily for them, the Salem Housing Authority recognized the fact that it wasn't their fault, and they adjusted the contract into a couple segments on it so that they were able to get the bonding and move ahead. But this is the type of thing, if we add another layer on this, and especially in this economy, this is going to be a big challenge. And so we were looking at this, that mandating 5-year warranties, especially for electrical and plumbing and HVAC. In the case of electrical and plumbing, we have the licensing of the contractors is much more stringent, and then the licensing of the individual craftsmen is out there also. These are very, you know, stringent programs and well-trained people out there. This would penalize good contractors, and so we really urge you not to move forward on this. But if there is something that you're wanting to continue to talk about in the interim on the issue, we will be there at the table.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Drew Hagedorn for the Associated General Contractors, also testifying in opposition to House Bill 3658. Why does AGC care about this bill? It's because it applies to multifamily housing projects. Under the code, it requires a commercial endorsement. So our folks are some of the people that build those kinds of projects. Echo some of the remarks of Mr. Berry and Mr. Krieg concerning the availability of an insurance product for this kind of requirement. Further, I want to remind everyone that in 2007, AGC sponsored and this assembly approved House Bill 3242. Recall that implemented a 2-year building envelope wrap warranty for commercial structures that would apply to the multifamily housing context. So in this instance, it's not as though a multifamily housing structure isn't without some shield for the building envelope envelope wrap, and our experience suggests that it's the wrap where most of these problems take place. So there is a product available for that purpose. And then finally, I would echo what Mr. Krieg said about just the newness of a product like this, the inability to find it in the marketplace, and just given the state of our industry, which is approaching 34% unemployment, we're truly in a depression, not just a recession. I question maybe whether this is the best time to be looking at this kind of a proposal. I think we, too, would be ready, willing, and able to look at interim options and things of that, and would want to be a part of those discussions. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. A question, Representative Tomei?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Krieg, you seem to say very positive things about the people that you represent, what good work they do. So if that's the case, then why would they be concerned about a warranty on their good work?
Chair Holvey, Representative Tomei, Mr. Berry talked about the concept of workmanship and who determines what workmanship is, and even the issues we have with inspectors who are well trained to be analyzing things, and the differences even between one inspector's viewpoint of what is the proper way to do certain things. You can build many things or do a project to code, but there's many different methods of doing that, the actual way you might wrap the duct, different techniques, different styles on that would still accomplish the same task and at code levels. You start to get into people deciding, well, is it potato or potato on here, and the only way that we're going to be able to sort that out after the short time period in the first year is realistically going to court on it. And therein lies part of our problems, in that the cost of insurance programs or bonding that we're going to have to get to back ourselves up to cover those types of issues is going to become very expensive. And that cost is going to be pushed back down to the homeowner again in the price of the home that they're going to be buying, which in Oregon we do have some high costs for housing. And Chair Holtley, if I could...
Certainly.
There was a question about the frequency of claims, and in the legislation that Mr. Hagedorn mentioned about the wrap, that is where most of the problems were, because with electrical, plumbing, HVAC types of issues, you're going to find the problem in the first 4 to 6 months, generally speaking. There's a very, very tiny percentage of problems that go on out very far.
So you pose an interesting question, and I appreciate Mr. Hagedorn's reference to House Bill 3242, which we worked on pretty hard, and I think it was a good piece of legislation, and impacts the commercial industry to some degree. It would be interesting to see if we could get that two-year wrap warranty on residential, where we see a lot more of that problem than I think we do in the commercial realm anyway. So that might be something we could definitely talk about as well. I appreciate your testimony and setting your positions as always. We'll definitely perhaps work on some more issues around this in the interim perhaps, and love to have both of you participate. Next up I have Mark Hughes. And Mark, you need to state your name for the record before you begin your testimony.
Okay.
And then you can just go ahead and let her rip.
Okay. My name is Mark Hughes, and I reside in Lake Oswego, Oregon. In 2006, I contracted with a general contractor to build a home. He proceeded to frame the house through the winter of 2006 and into 2007. And we took possession in May of 2007 on the home. And by early March of 2008, we were detecting odors within the house that caused us to have air quality tests. And what we found was a high level of mold on all three floors. There began the journey for me to figure out, as a new homeowner, how I'm supposed to deal with this. Of course, I thought it was a pretty simple process. But first and foremost, my concern was about the health of myself and my two children residing in the home. And it came to our attention that any problems that we may have with breathing or congestion or those kind of things may be indicators that it was a problem, and we literally moved out of our house in less than a year of occupancy And we began our journey to figure out how we're going to resolve this. Thinking that it was going to be a simple process, we contacted the builder. First of all, I secured an attorney who contacted the builder, and he informed me that in most cases, the builders don't respond, and so you literally have to go on to court. In the meantime, I contacted my insurance company to see what kind of coverage that I'd have for these defects, only to find out that mold is excluded from the coverage. And really, I had no recourse with my insurance company. We were then into the process of our lawsuit and found out that the builder's insurance excluded mold from his coverage. The bid to correct the construction defects in my house that caused me to move out of my house, not be able to rent my house, not be able to sell my house, was estimated about $545,000. The construction cost of the house was $385,000. So ultimately, the hygienist said that you should gut the inside of the house, gut the outside of the house, and start all over. I proceeded then with the lawsuit and contacted my lender to inform them that that I had this situation, that we were going to be entering into a long-term lawsuit that was going to result in me vacating the house for long periods of time, and ultimately indicated to them that I needed to develop a dialogue with them about how they wanted to handle this. And to my surprise, over a period of nearly a year and a half, my lender literally, how do I say this delicately, refused to respond or to address the issues, even at the request of my attorney, both in written form and in phone calls, asking them to participate literally in just a dialogue on how we could handle the problem. So what initially started out to be, and the most important thing here is what initially started out to be a defect of the builder and what it caused me economically and as a hardship upon myself and my family turned into a domino effect that literally after 2 years of fighting this has left me with a settlement that would not even come close to paying for my fees to initiate the lawsuit. So I am here mostly today to let you know that it is a very challenging position for a homeowner to be thrown in a situation where they trust that somebody is going to build them a good product, thinking and knowing that they're going forward with that agreement, and at the end of the day, they have no coverage. They have no recourse. They have nothing but to do but to hire an attorney. The contractor turns around and sues all the subcontractors. They wear you out. They drain you of all your financial resources. I sold my boat. I sold my car. I moved out of my brand new house and live in an apartment. And I've fed attorney's fees and inspection reports and engineering reports and special witnesses and all that kind of stuff to fight this case. And in the end, I ended up with paying me 5 cents on the dollar. There's an injustice there. And I don't know where to put the blame. You know, I thought going into this that I was mostly upset with the builder, but the reality is there's a domino effect that you need to understand. That when people fall victim to a builder not coming clean, not coming, stepping up to the plate and doing what they need to do, then the recourse to a consumer is pretty limited. Not everybody has the ability to write a $100,000 check to a law firm to say, fight this battle. So what do you do? And the domino effect, as everybody basically involved in the whole process, didn't want to touch it. I mean, I've learned since then, I have over 50 plus recorded voice messages with my lender and Fannie Mae explaining my situation and asking for them to respond with no response. What am I supposed to do? Where am I supposed to go? I thought this was just me. I thought I was an atypical situation. I thought I was the lone guy out that was having this unfortunate experience, only to find out through an association with a group of people that said, you're not atypical. You're part of, I mean, you're one of many. You're one of hundreds of people that are forced with this. I come to find out now that my lender had no motivation to work with me because it was easier to take my loan, to take my property and put it in the toxic asset category where the taxpayers will pay them for the house rather than deal with it in a cooperative manner to help me through this situation. And the real sad part about it is that if that bank takes over my house, which they'll probably do, after all this, I was told early on in the game, walk. Walk away. That didn't seem right to me. That didn't seem fair that I should just walk away and let the builder off the hook, only to enter into a nightmare, a twilight zone that's consumed my life for 2 years and literally left me without any, you know, all my resources are gone. But the bottom line is that this is a travesty that's happening to a lot of people with not a lot of recourse. Something needs to be done. I don't think there's a simple solution. I don't understand your bill. I haven't read your bill to really understand if this is the solution. But what you do need to know, what you do need to hear, is that my story is not a loan story. My story is very typical of consumers that are at the end of a contract with a builder who fails to live up to the contract and provide a good product, in my case, that I can even live in, that I can sell, or that I can rent. So it's been a nightmare for me, and I'm here today, and I actually speak in the community, in various communities, to free of charge, as a nonprofit organization that I founded, to help people overcome obstacles and the setbacks that come from these devastating experiences and how to cope with it, how to accept it. Because I've been there. I've been at a point of complete hopelessness. I've been there sleeping out on my deck in a sleeping bag on a blow-up mattress and looking at my life and saying, how the hell did I get here? And people need to know that they have recourse. So I know for me it's behind me, but my commitment is to get out there and to help other people that are going through these experiences and how do you cope with it, not just financially, but emotionally, because it's been very devastating for me emotionally and for my two children. So my message to you is don't treat this lightly, because it's a domino effect that takes people where they do not want to go. And I've certainly been there. And it has been, I mean, just try to understand what it's like when you tell somebody your story and they say, well, isn't the builder responsible? Yes. Well, can't you go after the builder? Well, he doesn't have the resources to do this. Well, he's got insurance, doesn't he? Well, yeah, but they exclude mold. It's baffling to people. It's mind-boggling that our system is set up that it's just accepted that that's just the way it is, and the consumer bears the brunt. That's really all I have to share.
Well, thank you. I know it's a tough issue to relive, probably talking about it. I have a question for you. So what's happening to the house now?
The house will go back to the bank, because I don't have the resources to fix the house. The settlement was ridiculous.
Mr. Chair?
And part of that, can I explain? Part of that is that to file the lawsuit, since the insurance company excludes mold, we couldn't state mold in the lawsuit. So since the bulk of the repairs was for mold remediation, we were hoping that we could get enough money in other avenues to create the money to pay for the mold, and it didn't happen. So that's, you know.
Thanks. Representative Krieger.
He's making me feel real good. They're putting the siding of my new house.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Down on the coast. But we didn't use Tyvek because it seals the moisture in. You use something that will breathe. Made sure that was dry before we started. What did they ever tell you why you ended up with mold? Was it wet lumber that got sealed up?
Yes, there was, since he framed it, since he framed it in the wintertime, there was water all over the the framing. I repeatedly asked him, are you going to dry this? Are you going to do something? He said, oh, we do this all the time. This is fine. And I used to go over with a push broom and push literally water out the slider door, the open slider door. And I think it's an education that's important, because even after this happened to me, I ran into a friend of mine that's been a realtor for 30-plus years, and he was doing a duplex at the coast with a builder, and they were getting ready to sheetrock, and I said, stop. Before you sheetrock, make sure you get in there and you dry that out, because you'll be surprised at what you find. And he came to me, you know, months later and said, I owe you big time, because we pulled buckets of water out of there. And, you know, it could have been Clackamas County Inspector that just simply required them to dry it before they sheetrocked it. It could have been the builder required to spend, I have learned, $400 for a company to come in and test for moisture in the wood to give an approval to be able to proceed with insulating and sheetrock. $400 would have saved me all these years and all my money fighting something that could have been prevented.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony. It's, you know, it does give us pause for sure about these sorts of situations. It's difficult to know, you know, from our chairs sometimes what should be done, you know, when we're trying to strike these balances to protect consumers. And it bothers me that we fall so short that something like that could happen to somebody. So I appreciate your testimony, and certainly I hope that it'll help us in continuing a conversation about what we can do about this type of situation.
Just know that I'm not alone. Yeah. That's the important thing. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. Representative Tomei.
Thank you. That was a very compelling story, and I hear you're not alone, and I know you're not alone, because we've heard other stories. It would be really helpful when we have hearings like this, when you can see that there are lobbyists for all kinds of folks who are doing the building. It would be really helpful. I'm glad you came. It would be helpful if we had a room full of people who had similar problems, so we know you are not an isolated case. So we see bodies here that say this is an issue that the legislature needs to address.
Well, there are bodies, and I mean, if you want me to bring them back, we've sort of developed a support group, and I've been amazed at the number of people that have had similar situations. Mine so far it meets the top in terms of the total experience and the lack of support from multiple areas.
Right.
But I'm not alone in terms of people losing their homes or being put in a very financially burdensome position as a result of shoddy workmanship that's left their house moldy.
And if people can't, if I may, Mr. Chair, if people can't come here, sending us letters, sending us emails, send us pictures so that we have evidence. So when we hear issues like this, that we have some backing to make the decisions that we need to make.
Okay, I will, from this day forward, forward that information into people that I talk to.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate
sure.
that. Representative Matthews.
And thank you for sharing your story. I'm hearing a couple different things, but in the bill what we're addressing is as it was just termed, shoddy workmanship. In this case, it seems like there was, for whatever reason, a home built in the wintertime and wrapped in, secured, and so, you know, wet lumber, basically. And over time, that has created mold. I'm curious, first of all, how did you catch the mold? Was it because of illness, sickness, and whatnot? But also, it's worth looking into, are there plans available for insurance for these builders and contractors for mold? Perhaps this is something that's not available for them to cover either. Because as terrible as your story is, which trust me, yes, it's compelling, I would also want to know that this, I believe, a lot of builders have built homes in the wintertime. A lot of wood has been wet. Some of that would turn into mold, but they're really two different things. We're looking at contractors that are making egregious errors and mm-hmm. having some problems with that kind of work. And then in this case, where perhaps the only way to avoid it, and you've got a great suggestion, dry it out first, and then it becomes a matter of steps in building. But I'm just curious if a plan out there even exists that would cover mold. You certainly didn't find one. The builder didn't have one. Your mortgage didn't provide one. And so I'm just curious just what's out there. And I think it's certainly worth us looking into again. And any information you can forward to us would be great. So continue your charge with your group.
I don't know the answer to that question. From my understanding is that you can get a rider to your insurance that includes mold. So maybe that's a process that everybody should just start adding on to their insurance. But then, of course, you know, why should the consumer be burdened with the responsibility of covering something that is the responsibility of a contractor that knows? And I think also the jurisdictions that approve this, I mean, there's very step-by-step process of what, you know, the foundation is first approved before you can start framing, then the framing is approved, then you can, you know, there's step-by-step processes. And certainly someone along the line should say, you know, have you dried this wood before you proceed to insulate and or sheetrock? Is that a bill that requires that? Is that a requirement of the builder that he pays for somebody to come in and certify? I don't know that answer.
Right. I'm sorry. But it's a worthwhile discussion to have. The other incident is obviously, and we deal with it every now and then, particularly the city of Gresham, we're allowing a lot of building on a lot of slope land. It's a beautiful area. But at some point, if that should shift for any reason, does that become the builder's responsibility or the folks that bought the property knowing that this was a risk? And that's where the balance is, and that's what we've got to find. Thanks for your time.
Yeah, and I appreciate your testimony again, and thank you. I will point out that, maybe I'll have Craig Smith come back up, but we did just pass a bill in 2008 that requires the moisture content be checked and be less than 17%, I believe, before it can be covered. But if I get Craig Smith to come back up and tell me if that if that's actually accurate, and did that is that in effect?
And I think that if that is accurate, then the question you do is track the incidences of mold happening since then.
Yeah.
Craig Smith, Chair Hovey, this is a building code requirement, as I understand it. There's some debate back hallways back here whether it's 17 or 16%, but there is a requirement now, and this is one of the things, of course, that during that task force on construction claims it became rather clear that if you're building homes in Oregon, you cannot close the building up and then start putting that drywall on until the structure is dry. And so there is a requirement. I can't tell you the precise amount, but that was something that was addressed during that time.
So I guess to follow up with that is, and I didn't notify the Building Codes Division because I didn't foresee going down this particular path. But I'm wondering, and maybe Scott has an answer to it. Is anybody checking the houses today as a result of that law to check the moisture content before they cover up, or is it just on the books and the inspectors don't look at it and you're just left up to the good faith that the builder's taking care of it?
Yeah, Chair Holby, it wouldn't be a question for me. It might be a question for building codes in local jurisdictions. I can't answer that.
Okay, thank you. It's a question I'll follow up with.
Okay.
Appreciate that. Thank you. Committee, sorry, it went a little bit longer than I thought, but I thought it was very compelling to hear the other side of the story, I guess. And we'll maybe revisit this issue in the future. With that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3658. I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 3657. Patrick, would you give us a brief summary of the bill, please?
I would be glad to, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3657 prohibits the owner of a foreclosed residential property from neglecting upkeep on the property during periods when the property is vacant. It would permit local government to assess a civil penalty for each day during which the owner fails to remedy the conditions of neglect. This would sunset on January 2nd, 2014, and has an emergency clause. You have in your packets a dash one amendment. The dash one amendment specifies that the fine does not excludes properties that are owned, foreclosed properties that, for which the owner is a local government. It specifies that the owner must contest the assessment within 10 days after the notification of the assessment. And it specifies that unpaid civil penalty under the measure constitutes a lien against foreclosed property prior to and superior to any other lien other than a tax lien. And I think some of our witnesses are going to speak to that amendment, Mr. Chair.
Yes. Thank you, Patrick. Yes, and I believe that there's an issue with the lien in this bill, and it was the Chair's intent to address the size of the per-day violation on that. It seemed a little bit steep to me, so it'd be something I want to take a look at. So with that, Scott Winkles. Welcome. If you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
Mr. Chairman, for the members of the committee, for the record, Scott Winkles representing the League of Oregon Cities. I'm the author of the Dash 1 amendments, and Mr. Brennan is correct. The issue with the lien, it would be our desire that be removed from the amendment and for future reference. There are some issues with some case law, and it's probably not an appropriate issue for the February session to move forward. Additionally, one of the things, cities have been found themselves in a position that many of them have never, are not accustomed to. The housing crisis has left numerous homes foreclosed. There are tracts of housing around the state where the builder has gone bankrupt and the bank's taken over. Happy Valley, Bend, those areas have been hit particularly hard. So cities are struggling to cope with this foreclosure issue. There have been a number of problems you've probably seen in the news in Happy Valley where prostitution rings and other criminal activity have taken place in foreclosed homes. And cities are struggling to address those issues and address the livability for the neighbors that have remained in their homes. To the bill specifically, one of the things we noticed when we first looked at the bill was that there was no time frame for which a person could appeal. The person wasn't required to appeal the notification or the contest in a specific time frame. So what would happen conceivably is that a person could wait till the 28th day of the 30-day notice required in the bill, request the appeal, and prolong the process. Typically, when a city enacts a local ordinance, they require a prompt response from the owner, usually within 10 days. Additionally, the owner of the definition would have allowed a city to fine another jurisdiction that had foreclosed on the property for tax purposes. Cities don't generally want to be in the business of fining the county for foreclosing on the property. It might be interesting to do so, but out of respect to my esteemed colleagues at the Association of Oregon Counties, we agreed to include that in the legislation. Additionally, and to the chair's point, the $1,000 a day is fine. It's simply too much. The purpose in imposing a fine on a nuisance property is twofold. First, it's to entice the owner to abate the nuisance, or B, to allow the local government to recoup whatever cost they've expended in enforcing their code, or in abating the nuisance themselves. Typically what a city will do is give the notice maybe 10 days, or give the owner maybe 10 days to abate the nuisance. If they choose not to do that, the city will send a public works crew out, abate themselves, bill the owner for the cost plus usually 10% above for administrative fees. So that was the that's the motive in fining. It's not necessarily to be punitive or to be overly harsh. It's simply to help address livability in the community. With that, I'm eager to take the questions.
Questions from the committee? Mr. Winkles, just one. You know, you mentioned the nuisance, you know, and I know some cities have nuisance ordinances, but probably some don't, and I assume that the city sees this as a sort of a state tool for local governments to use to deal with this problem in lieu of a nuisance ordinance, which may have a whole different process.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, correct. The cities do have the authority to enact a local nuisance ordinance. This would give them an option whether they could file under their own or under their own. And conceivably, there are some cities where or other jurisdictions that have not encountered this problem before and don't have an ordinance on the books.
And one final question for you in regards to the $1,000. Has the city contemplated what they think would be a reasonable penalty in order to that would motivate the owner of the foreclosed property to deal with the problems?
Mr. Chairman, typically what a city would want to do is charge the owner of the property for the cost plus 10% that they've incurred in abating the nuisance, because we don't. If someone chooses not to abate the nuisance on their property, you don't just let it fester and rack up the fees, because it creates all kinds of problems in the neighborhood. You take aggressive action and send a crew out and fix it. So whatever the cost that the city would incur in doing so, plus the administrative overhead, would be appropriate, and I think there's a way to phrase that.
So does this bill propose that kind of a process? In the dash one?
It doesn't in its current form. It could, though.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Winkles?
Question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know we're not aiming this at local governments, but why would we exempt them?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, it creates there are mechanisms for the city to go to a county and address this internally. The county may not, there may be some legal issues that we haven't fully vetted or explored as well. I would defer to my colleague from AOC has actually signed up as well, and I would defer there. This is an issue that they had requested be placed in the bill, and I complied out of the spirit of cooperation.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Related question, how are you differently situated than another party? Why you should get sort of different treatment? Not only why, I mean, I can understand why you wouldn't want to have the bill apply to you, but why would you be in a different position than someone to whom the bill would apply?
Representative Holvey, Chair Holvey, Representative Smith, typically it's not the city that does the tax foreclosure. It would be done by the county. Mm-hmm. They generally do the property tax assessments. Essentially, we would be, if the city wanted to, we did foreclose on a property, essentially we'd be in a position of fining ourselves.
Say the last part again.
If the city had foreclosed on the property, we would essentially be in a position of fining, the city would fine itself,
right.
As they would become the owner.
Right. Confused.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I imagine at some point it would look kind of bad for the taxpayers to be suing taxpayers for that too. It probably wouldn't look good in the paper. So I appreciate your testimony. Up next, I have Paul Cosgrove.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul Cosgrove, representing Oregon Financial Services Association and appearing on behalf of the United Financial Lobby, which includes the banks and the credit unions, folks who make real estate loans. In the January hearing days, I made a few brief comments about this bill because it was the first time I had seen it and wondered whether it was really necessary, because I think, as I mentioned to the committee, it was my understanding that most cities and counties, in fact, had nuisance ordinances, and in my personal experience, representing lenders who sometimes take property that has already been subject to a nuisance violation, that the prior owner had abandoned it and the city had already moved in, so I've had some experience with this. that there was a lot of cities who were pretty active in this area. And I promised, I think, to try to do some investigation and figure out if, in fact, my impression was correct, that this bill isn't needed because there are already local ordinances that fulfill this need. What I have found, and I've worked with Mr. Winkles, and he's been very helpful, and with the representative of the county most recently, just briefly today, and also with title company attorneys who are, frankly, probably the most familiar with what happens with liens, whether they be nuisance liens or any other kind of liens on property, is that to the best of everybody's recollection or knowledge, nearly every city and probably most counties also have already nuisance ordinances. They run the gamut from ordinances that are very strict and call things like keeping your RV on the street for too many days a nuisance, to ordinances that are more lenient and just try to attack more serious problems like front yard full of abandoned cars and things like that. But each of the cities has decided on its own what is a nuisance, and it is also now completely clear that the issue of how the city can enforce it is completely within the authority of the city to do, so long as the city's charter allows for liens. And my title company attorneys thought that at least all the major cities they were aware of, the charter for those cities did, and of course charters can be amended if they don't. And so long as the ordinance applied the appropriate priority for the lien, cities have authority to make the lien a first priority lien. So the lien issue, which may not be able to be addressed in this bill, in fact is already addressed in a good set of city ordinances. The priority issue has been tested in the courts, and I found that I was told that a case in the Oregon Supreme Court in 1985, called the State of Oregon acting by and through the Director of Veterans Affairs versus Vickery, who was the former property owner, the DVA's interest in the case, they were the first mortgage lender of DVA loan. The city of Portland asserted a nuisance lien against the property, and the issue before the court was who had priority. Did the city, did DVA, or other lien holders? And the court ruled that the city of Portland's lien was a first priority lien only behind property taxes. So I think the issue of the priority and the enforceability of city liens is settled, that the practice is that most, if not all, cities and local governments have that authority. I also, and they have the tools already, in other words, to address the problem in whatever way they want to define nuisance to be, whether it be a strict definition or a more lenient one as the city chooses. I also spoke with your colleague who had testified in January about the situation in her town, and I think it's fair, and I won't try to characterize what she her position is with respect to this bill, but what I learned was that in, at least in that case, it was a situation where a number of constituents who were members of homeowners associations had concerns that the city wasn't adequately using its authority or to address concerns like this. And so I point out to you that, in fact, unfortunately, this bill doesn't help that situation, because what it provides is the city would have to act under this state authority, just like the city would have to act under its city authority. And if there is a city that isn't willing to act, this isn't likely to solve that problem. So because of that, and because we think there is, we're perfectly happy as lenders who take properties over in foreclosure to abide by whatever requirements a local government has. We just would rather not be treated differently than some other kind of lender or other kind of owner, like an absentee landlord or just a neglectful homeowner. We would respectfully suggest this bill isn't needed. And in fact, if there are problems in individual cities with particular lenders who are bad managers of their property, we'd be happy to pledge to work with those city governments to try to rectify them and to help them exercise their authority under their current ordinances to correct the problem and put liens on the property if necessary. So that's I appreciate the time to testify here today, and would urge the committee that I think this bill is actually not needed, but we would be happy to work on the real solutions to the problem, which is, I think, more likely to be case by case, city by city. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Happy to answer questions.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony, and do realize that, you know, there are other ordinances like nuisance ordinances that are available to many cities. But I think as Mr. Winkles testified, that this would give another option to cities to pursue foreclosed properties under the state law as opposed to their nuisance law. And I think it's a tool that's it's important to a lot of local governments who may not have an adequate ability to pursue a nuisance ordinance, and it might not provide them the remedy that they want. And I think this sort of sets a standard, frankly, I think it is just another tool in the toolbox for city government to deal with this as we see foreclosures increasing around the state. So I just... it wasn't a question, but appreciate your testimony. Questions for Mr. Cosgrove? Not seeing it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next up, I have Ann Hannes. Hannes?
Good afternoon, Chair Holvey and members of the committee. My name is Ann Hannes, and I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties. You heard earlier from Scott Winkles. We do ask your support for the amendment that would exempt local governments as owners of foreclosed properties. Counties do get tax foreclosed properties, and a lot of times they are odds and ends or in very poor shape after you've gone through about the six-year foreclosure process. So we want to work with cities on there to implement this bill, and we think that that would be a way to make sure that we can administer this properly.
Thank you. Questions?
Representative Tomei. I'm still struck with that. Why private owners or lenders would be responsible and not a city or a county government be responsible for similar properties?
Chair Holvey, Representative Tomei, we get the facts of the tax foreclosure properties, and usually we'll sell them right away. So they're not ones that we allow to go into neglect, and we don't want to really hold them for any length of period of time. The tax foreclosures often are maybe less than the tax is usually paid if it's a bank, and they've got the foreclosure back because the tax payments are going to be less than what the total value of the property is, so that's going to be paid off. So the kind of odds and ends that we have are ones that we would sell off.
We would also
try to
follow up.
Go ahead.
So if I'm living in a house, and next door is a house that the bank foreclosed, and next door is a house that the county has foreclosed, why would I be satisfied that the bank is forced to fix up their property but not the county? And I understand what you're saying, that probably you would sell it quicker, but still, if I'm the neighbor, why would I suffer through one and not the other?
What we would do is we would manage a property, and we have mechanisms to be able to do that. In fact, we can accelerate the tax foreclosure process if we see a property that's going into disrepair, because it's not in the interest of the community that we want to see that happen.
Go ahead.
Representative Smith.
Your comments, while helpful, seem to me to be answers to a question of why it wouldn't burden you very much to have the requirement imposed upon you, because you wouldn't be holding the property for very long, because you wouldn't, you know, wouldn't cause a big problem, rather than an answer to the question of why the burden shouldn't be imposed upon you. And I'm still struggling, and I'm slow on many things, I assure you. And Representative Gilliam reminds me of that in various notes he passes me. But on this, I think we need to hold government to a high standard, and I want to understand why we would treat the public sector different from the private sector in this instance. I sort of understood, well, maybe we'd be suing ourselves. I sort of get that. But this isn't about a private right of action. This is about holding you to a certain standard, I think.
Yeah, and I think, often, if we get a tax foreclosed property, when we get that tax foreclosed property, it's in a bad state to begin with. So then, you know, we would need to take action at that point to make sure that either the property is in a shape that we can sell it, or that we fix it up at that point, and then we can turn around and sell it right away so that the neighborhood does become a livable place to be. There's another way to handle that other than going through using a fine against ourselves to fix the property.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you. I'll wait for the mail to be delivered if you'd like. thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I understand why you would bring forward the amendment, and I respect that. Mm-hmm. In my view, the hypocrisy would be ours if we pass this bill with that amendment. That's just my opinion. I don't blame you mm-hmm. for what you're trying to do, because it's a terrible situation. And for me, Mr. Chair, the tough part of this bill is we've got lots of homes in foreclosure, more than we want, more than we should. And it causes a great problem for neighborhoods and for neighbors that are kind of snotty, like Representative Tomei. Mm-hmm. And it causes a lot of problems for
at least the House rules.
For the entities that are trying to clean them up.
Point of order, I believe that it's appropriate for you to comment on Representative Tomei in such fashion.
The person that Representative Tomei was characterizing in her pantomime, certainly not her.
Stop digging.
Right. All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will
cede back the remainder of his
Daniel Webster.
So my point is this. The difficulty with these foreclosures is, to me, underlined by the county coming forward and saying how difficult it is, and how their whole point is to move on and get them sold. This bill, I believe, well-intentioned, is badly timed because of the fact that we could be, in my view, just adding more burden onto the a multitude of folks who have lost their home and who are going through foreclosure difficulties and all the rest of it, and we're adding more regulation and more, and I know you're reevaluating the steep penalties, but I think this is exactly the wrong time to add more regulation to folks who are losing their homes.
Are you going to answer that one there, Riley, before I do?
Yeah. This obviously, thank you, Mr. Chair, obviously this doesn't put any more regulation on people who are losing their homes. It puts more regulation on the people who are taking their homes. So.
Thank you.
If I'm asking a question, I'm not arguing.
Follow-up, Representative Gilliam.
So, Representative Riley, if I'm incorrect, and I often am, mm-hmm. wouldn't there be folks who, going through the foreclosure of their home, are about to lose it? Wouldn't they be under this ordinance?
No.
Okay, I withdraw my criticism.
Thank you. I think this, is flippant as the conversation may have gotten for a few minutes, this is a big issue for mm-hmm. neighborhoods where foreclosed properties are not taken care of, and it actually does hurt the valuation of the neighbors in the community, and they have a vested interest to make sure that foreclosed properties are taken care of. And we did have some testimony from in a different committee about this issue from some bankers who said absolutely foreclosed properties and the owners of foreclosed properties should be taken care of them, and this is a serious issue, and it has impacts in some neighborhoods much more than others, and has a degrading impact on a community, and I think it's a serious issue. And notwithstanding the ability of local governments to have nuisance ordinances, I believe that this bill provides them an alternative to their nuisance ordinance if it doesn't seem to be readily available or adequate in a certain circumstance to address this particular situation when it becomes a problem widespread in a community. So with that, I appreciate the opportunity to provide my comment on it,
and thank you very much for your testimony.
And I do agree it's a serious problem, and we do want to have it in the interest of making sure that these properties are in good shape.
Thank you. Appreciate that. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3657 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3659. And I expected to see a lot more people in the audience than I do, but I'm not disappointed necessarily.
How did we get to it?
Patrick, would you give us a brief summary of the new improved bill?
Sure, Mr. Chair. The original bill dealt with rescission practices for health insurance policies. We have before us, however, Dash 1 amendment, which will replace the original measure. The replacement amendment establishes a temporary high-risk pool program. It specifies that the program is to be administered by the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool Board and authorizes the Oregon Health Authority to seek approval from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services to obtain federal funding for the program. It would become operative upon receipt of federal approval and would sunset January 2nd, 2016. The Dash 1 amendment has an emergency clause and would take effect upon signature by the governor.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And before us, we have Tom Jovic. I don't know
correct.
If that's how you pronounce it, welcome to the committee. If you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. My name is Tom Jovic. I'm the administrator of the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, which is located within the Office of Private Health Partnerships, and we administer and our several programs for the Oregon Health Authority and are located within the Oregon Health Authority. I'm here to testify in favor of House Bill 3659 as amended. There is another amendment, a Dash 2 amendment, that I do not believe that you have yet received. We have not received it, but I will talk about what that amendment does. This is completely different than anything you've been talking about so far today.
Probably much to the delight of many.
Very briefly, this bill allows us to take advantage of federal funds that may become available should the federal government pass a major health reform and allow the states to use those funds to ensure more lives through the state's high-risk pool. For those of you who don't know what the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool is, I just want to give you a little brief background on it. The pool has been around since 1990. We are what is known as the high-risk pool for the state. We insure about 15,000 people in the state. And on those 15,000 people in 2009, we spent about $180 million for medical services. There are three ways to get into the pool right now. The primary way is called medical eligibility. So if any of you were to apply to the individual commercial insurance market for health insurance and you had some chronic condition, could be asthma, could be diabetes, could be major heart condition, could be any of a number of conditions. The insurance companies have the right to turn you down for coverage. Until this pool became in existence, there was no alternative for people to get insurance. And what people did was basically spend themselves down into poverty to become eligible for the Oregon Health Plan or Medicaid. So once a person is turned down, they are automatically notified that they're eligible for our pool, and as long as they are an Oregon resident, they can come into our risk pool. It's not free. They pay premiums, but they get the coverage. Another way to get into this pool is if you have been covered by group health insurance and you lose that insurance and you have no portability option in the state. So normally what will happen is if your company buys insurance through one of the major carriers, say ODS, Regence, Kaiser, whatever, they have what's called a fully insured insurance product. And once they lose their job and exhaust continuation benefits through, say, COBRA, they are eligible to get automatically a portability policy through that insurer, as long as they pay the premiums. And that coverage starts the day after they lose their COBRA coverage. If you work for a self-insured company that basically insures all the risk itself, there is no commercial portability coverage available because there is no commercial insurer. In those cases, those people are automatically eligible for our portability coverage. And it's the same kind of portability coverage that is available in the commercial market. About 15% of our covered lives come through the portability route. There are about 50 people that come to us a different way. These are people that have an 80% federal premium subsidy to come into the pool because they have lost their jobs due to foreign trade. And there's a special federal program called the Health Coverage Tax Credit that makes these people eligible for our coverage and eligible for that tax credit as long as the program exists and as long as they're basically paying the premium. We have only two ways of funding this program. One is through premiums, which currently cover about 50% of our costs, and the other is through assessments on the licensed Oregon insurance companies. And so in 2009, our premiums covered about $90 million of our costs, and the other $90 million basically came to us by way of an assessment that we levy on the commercial health insurers in this state. Now, what they do is pass that assessment on to the people that they insure in the form of a surcharge on premiums. There are no state funds that fund this program, and currently there are no federal funds for this program. The program is governed by a board, a 9-member board, that includes 4 insurance company, domestic insurance company executives, 2 member or consumer reps, 1 physician, and 2 state representatives. One is the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. The other is the director of the Oregon Health Authority. We contract with Regence Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon to be our third-party administrator. What they do is pay the claims, process applications, enroll people, do case management, medical management, and provide us reports and data. So there are about 34 risk pools in the country currently. In the last several months, with the debates over health care reform at the congressional level and at the White House, and the passage of a House bill and a Senate bill on national health reform, there has been a lot of discussion about using the state high-risk pools to provide interim coverage to uninsured individuals across the country until there is a broader-based reform. And the expectation still is that broader-based reform, which would be more in the form of universal coverage, would probably take place no earlier than 2014. What these bills do is direct the Secretary of Health and Human Services to establish a federal temporary high-risk pool program and to look to the states to administer that program. And our understanding is that the federal government would look to first the state high-risk pools to administer these programs. The Senate bill allocates $5 billion over a 3-year period to be distributed to the states to administer this program. And based on the population in Oregon, if we were to get a portion of that money. We estimate it would be about $50 million over a three-year period. That could help us insure another 2,000 to 3,000 people average per year. So the way it would work is there'd be a premium charge for a portion of the coverage, and the balance would be of the expenditures would be made up by federal funds. So in that program, two sources of funds. One is premiums, the other is federal funds. What this bill, we're interested in this bill because what it does is creates the opportunity for the state to jump on board that program and to access those funds. There are no statutes that currently allow the state to do that. And our understanding is that at the federal level, the bills could still pick up some momentum. They could pass something summer or a little bit later with a rapid implementation date. In the current bills, the implementation date is 90 days out from the passage of the bill. What that means is they could be looking to the states to apply to administer these programs before the 2011 legislative session, and without legislative authority to go after these funds, the state would not be in a position to tap into them. So what this bill does then is it authorizes the Oregon Health Authority to apply to be the administrator of that program, should it deem it feasible. And then if they do that and the state is granted the ability to administer that program, the administration would be done through the Oregon Medical Insurance Board. And what the board would do is basically determine eligibility requirements, benefit coverage, and premium levels in such a way that it maximizes the federal dollars that would come to the state. There is an amendment in this that will be coming to this bill that basically creates a special fund for paying for both claims and administration of this program. And the reason that amendment is there is to make it clear that there are no funds for the current Oregon Medical Insurance Pool that could be used to administer that fund. This federal program does not replace the current pool, and in fact, the people that are covered under the current state pool would not be eligible for that program. So what that amendment really does is protects those funds, and it doesn't increase the assessment that goes out to the licensed Oregon insurers to support that program. This bill is an emergency measure, primarily because it would allow us to take advantage of those funds, and because there is not a legislative authority to do that now. So I'm here to request that you support this bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Jurek. Bless you. You provided us a very thorough and complete, I think, synopsis of the OMIP and the situation we're finding ourselves in with regards to the potential of federal monies and the need for this bill. And I appreciate you and all those that brought this to my attention, and we're glad we had a vehicle to make this happen. So. With that, is there any questions from the committee? I appreciate that. This is a great government accountability measure, since our committee handles government accountability, because it would certainly be inappropriate for our government not to be prepared to accept some funds to help insure some people. So thank you very much. Representative Tomei.
So this is the proverbial gun and stuff, right? This has nothing to do with the original bill.
That is correct. As is on the agenda, you see it. The amendment totally replaces the bill.
Okay, I missed that. Thank you.
Mm. my committee administrator reminds me of something we're talking about, and that is fiscal impacts that this would have on the state, or this bill would have on the state. Do you have any preliminary guesses or knowledge about that topic?
The fiscal impact is that it brings new funds into the state federal funds, so it would be $50 million over...
And fiscal, I was referring to, are there costs to the state to do this?
Should be no cost to the state. There's no impact on general funds. We're not asking for any other source of funds for this program. All of the money to support it comes from either premiums that the enrollees would pay or the funds from the federal government.
Thank you. Thank you for that. I appreciate it. Any other questions? Not seeing any questions from the committee, so thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank
you.
With
that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3657. Oh, it was the wrong bill?
This is 59.
Oh, let me close the public hearing on the House Bill 3659. Excuse me. Looking at the wrong piece of paper. So, committee, I think that concludes our work for this week, and we will be reconvening on Monday with a relatively large agenda on Monday. And I believe most everything's been posted for next week. So look forward to seeing you there. With that, I'll close the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Accountability.